Good afternoon. My name is Rachel, and I will be your conference operator today. At this time, I would like to welcome everyone to the AABGU Special Live from Israel update. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. After the speaker's remarks, there will be a question-and-answer session. If you would like to ask a question during this time, simply press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. If you would like to withdraw your question, press the pound key. Thank you. Mr. Joel Reinstein, you may begin your conference.
Thank you. I want to welcome everybody to this phone conference. I know this is an exciting time, and we have a very, very real expert with us, and it's my pleasure to be the host. My name is Joel Reinstein. I'm a member of the National Board of AABGU. It's really a pleasure to welcome everybody and to have Professor Yoram Maital on the phone with us. As you may remember, approximately 30 years ago, Anwar Sadat and Prime Minister Begin met at Ben-Gurion University. It was President Sadat's first trip to Israel, and it was an amazing meeting. I recently saw pictures of a young Sadat, a young Begin, and standing next to him was Hosni Mubarak, who was also quite young at that time. Just amazing to see the Ben-Gurion University picture right behind them, banner right behind them. I know this is a very difficult time for American Jews and Israelis watching anxiously the events that are happening in Egypt. I know we're excited that the Egyptian people may actually have a democratic regime, and hopefully it'll be a democratic regime. But we're all concerned about what this future holds for Israel. One of the reasons that Ben-Gurion University organized this conference call was because of that anxiety that we all feel. We wanted to have a professional, a top-notch professional, come on board to really help us understand the implications of the developments that are happening in Egypt and all over the Arab world, the implications to Israel. Professor Maital is the chair of Ben-Gurion University's Chaim Herzog Center for Middle Eastern Studies and Diplomacy. It's a center that specializes in Middle Eastern affairs, the politics of the Arab states, and focuses on the nationalism that's appearing all over the Middle East. The Herzog Center specializes in bringing leaders together from both the arts and sciences to basically focus on just the kinds of things that are just now exploding in the Middle East. Professor Maital, as Rachel mentioned, will be answering questions after he talks to us. And I'd like to turn the floor over. It's my pleasure to turn the floor over to Professor Maital to give us his remarks. Professor?
Yeah, thank you so much. Good afternoon, everyone. I'm very pleased to take part in this briefing, and I look forward to your comments and questions following my presentation. I think I might address the situation by looking into three levels out of many, of course, perspectives about the situation in Egypt. And the first level is just to give you my reading of the internal domestic struggle over power in post-Mubarak's Egypt. I mean that I don't want to take the time and to introduce the developments and the causes and the historical perspectives of this popular uprising. I think that I would, at the first level, discuss more the current struggle over power in Egypt. So this is the first level. And the second level I would like to address is the uprising impacts on Egypt's overall policy including relationships with the United States of America, and of course with Israel, as we already heard at the introductory remarks. The third level, briefly I would like to address the impact of the developments in Egypt on the broader Middle East, means mainly the impacts on other Arab societies live under authoritarian regime. So these are the three levels of discussion that I suggest to introduce. So allow me to jump quickly to the first level and to open up with a question. Will Egypt successfully get past the transition stage in which it finds itself now? Now, this is a huge question. This is actually, to my mind, this is the question, it's the key question to understanding the reality that may characterize post-Mubarak Egypt. Continuation of the current trend affords a real chance for a civilian government, to my mind, one created after and only after free elections. On the other hand, if the military continues to hold the reins of government, that can lead to renewal of the violence. So we have at this point in time very early to see where the trends will go. I think that it is very important to emphasize here that at the current situation, a new political map is getting to the forefront in the internal Egyptian politics. The end of the Mubarak era has completely reshuffled the cards in the internal political scene. In addition to veteran political parties and movements, are clearly to be seen the activities of new political organizations, and we already see this happen nowadays in Egypt. The vacuum which has been created in the public space by the retreat of Mubarak's National Democratic Party, this was the ruling party, is in the process of being filled by groups such as the 6 April movement. It's a new movement which has actually initiated the whole wave of the present demonstrations and the uprising, or by other fronts and associations and political movements. One particular important player here is, of course, the Muslim Brotherhood movement. Now, I would say that contrary to widespread fears, not only in Israel, all over the world, I do not anticipate an Islamic takeover in Egypt. In the free democratic space that I see filling the void left by the disintegration of Mubarak's National Democratic Party, the Muslim Brotherhood is more likely to be, to my mind, maybe it will surprise most of you, but to my mind, the Muslim Brotherhood is more likely to decline than to grow. And the reason that I think is behind this argument is that large segments of the Egyptian people will have now a new political alternatives that were not available to them before. In other words, new parties will emerge which could take at least some of the Muslim Brotherhood vote. The Muslim Brothers, just to make my argument very clear, the Muslim Brothers will remain an important part of the Egyptian polity, but not the biggest or the most important part, and I mean by that, they most certainly will not be the only alternative to the ruling party as it used to be for decades. As for the Egyptian policy in general, I think that Egypt's commitments to the guiding principle will be upheld. I see more of continuity in the general political orientation in the coming government and new government in Egypt. The army, the main seat of power, is well aware of the critical importance of continuing to cooperate with the West. The top bureaucracy officers and the economic elite in Egypt fully support the current policy. Statements, in addition to this, statements by leaders of major groups among the uprising camp support this continuation. They perceive the continuation of the strategic partnership with the U.S., including the peace with Israel, as a necessary condition to safeguard their country's most vital interest. The factors that led to the adoption of this policy 30 years ago are, in my view, even more relevant today than before, especially today with the huge challenges to the coming government in Egypt. Now, as for relations with Israel, I argue that the huge socio-economic, foreign policy, and security challenges any new Egyptian regime will face will propel it towards maintaining the peace deal with Israel as part, as I already said, of its calling card to the West and especially the U.S., which, as we, I guess, all know, the U.S. provides Egypt with a massive $1.3 billion in annual aid. On the overarching strategic level, the army understands this, and while it will not take control of the government, it will insist on keeping the peace with Israel. Still, on the government, and I would like to emphasize this, when I'm saying that the overall commitment to the peace treaty with Israel will continue and relationship with the United States, I would like to emphasize that, to my mind, still, on the government-to-government level, the Israeli government and the Egyptian government, the new elected government, on this level, I anticipate growing friction. That is because I see a connection between the new political domain in Egypt and the policy of the incoming government. In other words, it will be more attuned to popular sentiment in Egypt and therefore more critical of Israeli policies. The voices of criticism already present in Egyptian society will find their way into parliament and into the government. I think that serious disagreements and tensions will be raised, especially on the Gaza Strip and the relationships or the policy towards Hamas regime in Gaza. And this is, of course, a very sensitive point and actually a gate for ocean of disagreements between any Israeli government and an elected government in Egypt. Of course, we are all aware of the fact that President Mubarak has become friend of Israeli policy in recent years due to the fact that both countries saw Hamas as a negative, threatening player. Mubarak's government strongly opposed the establishment of a mini-state under Hamas leadership in the Gaza Strip and works in various ways to prevent such a development, including with a very close cooperation in intelligence with Israel and with the United States in this regard. Now, the Mubarak's downfall could affect the situation in Gaza Strip dramatically. a new Egyptian regime likely, most likely, will turn over, we say it, a new page in relations with Hamas, and play a new policy in issues such as the Rafah border crossing and the question of arms smuggling from the Sinai Peninsula into the Gaza Strip. One, I think, very outstanding issue that could be affected first is, of course, the Israeli policy of isolation that Israel enforced on Gaza Strip, and during the last couple of years with the help from the Egyptians. Now, if the Egyptian army stop cooperation with Israel in these issues, it could allow more heavy weapons such as anti-tank missiles to be smuggled into Gaza, and this could introduce Israel with some significant challenges coming from Gaza, or maybe if happened the confrontation between Israel and Hamas, it could affect dramatically the situation. From here, I think I would like to cross to the issue of the Egyptian uprising impact on the Middle East in general. Now, many scholars talking nowadays about this domino effect in the Middle East. Well, no doubt that the successful uprising in Egypt is already seen by other Arab societies who live under authoritarian regimes as a model lesson in civil protest, and therefore this uprising could spread across the entire Middle East and create in many ways a new map or political map in the Middle East. If the Egyptian society and regime, and this is the big question now, all this could happen widely if the Egyptian society and regime cross successfully the current transitional stage. Means that at this stage, the reins of government are in the hands of the army. But the consensus in Egypt and the agreement between the army and the forces that that actually have led the uprising is that the army is holding the reins of power just for a short span of time that could be between 4 months into a year. And in this transitional stage, they have the two sides, the army and the civil society forces, have a huge challenge, and this is to put amendments into the constitution that could lead into free elections to the parliament and the presidency of the Republic of Egypt. If the Egyptian society and regime, the current regime, will cross this test successfully, I think that we will see a more dramatic impact on other Arab societies who live under authoritarian regimes. Of course, we all have already seen some, I would say, startup efforts to call upon uprising, mainly in Bahrain, Yemen, Algeria, and even in Jordan, a neighbor to Israel, who, of course, have a peace treaty with Israel since October 1994. And this is, again, from the Israeli perspective, a point of concern about what will happen if uprising would continue in neighboring Jordan. Now, if I try to rush into something about today or the current event and the near future, I would say that a part of the festive atmosphere in Egypt, the major issue that I can see is a mountain of challenges, both domestic and external, await Hosni Mubarak's successor in the presidential palace and, of course, in the parliament. Now, one point that I would like to emphasize is the expectations that erupted with the uprising. Now, expectations today in Egypt are extremely high, but the extremely difficult situation is not going, I would say, anymore tomorrow. And I mean especially about the economic situation, about unemployment rates, about the lower level of local currency, and all this actually await to the coming. To the coming government. So that in one hand we have this festive atmosphere, very positive, and people really, I would say, even smile. They know that they face now, even during the transitional phase, huge obstacles coming in the road. But the atmosphere is very positive, and many believe that as much as they were able to cross the uprising successfully, they are in the way to establish a more open system of government with multi-party parties and civil society forces coming to the public sphere. The demand for a swift and comprehensive change in the rules of the political game, and expectations to significant improvement in the conditions of life of tens of millions of citizens. Now we talk about 85 plus million Egyptians. These are all shared by different sectors in Egyptian society today, and these grievances cannot be addressed effectively by rhetorical commitments to democratization. I think I will stop here and take your comments and questions.
Professor, thank you very much. We really, really enjoyed your presentation. I mean, it really went right to the issues of today, and I know there are a lot of questions out there. There are over 80 participants on the call today, and because of that, I would like to ask everybody's to try to make their questions as succinct as possible, and of course, not to enter into any political debates. I mean, we really want to hear from the professor and get his expertise. While everybody's writing or thinking about their questions, I wanted to pose a question to the professor.
Oh, I'm sorry. Can I interrupt you a moment? If we could just have the operator instruct folks on getting in the queue before you do that.
Okay, absolutely. Rachel, could you do that, please?
Yes, sir. In order to ask a question, please press star, then the number 1 on your telephone keypad.
Okay, great. Thank you. Professor, in light of the dramatic changes that have taken place in the Middle East over the last several weeks, from an Israeli perspective, what role should the U.S. Take in assisting the Iranian people in achieving their own form of change of government?
Well, this is, of course, an excellent question. I think that it will be wise in general, not only to the U.S. Government, but in general, not to try to propel uprising or to propel oppositional forces, but to take the necessary steps only and only after we saw some, resistance, as we had seen, I guess we all remember, about a year ago with the Iranian supporters of Mousavi getting to the streets, not only in Tehran, the capital city, but in other cities in Iran. At this point, it is extremely, helpful if the Americans would come and send, in general, positive messages to the resistance camp in Iran. But my understanding is that as much as the Americans or foreigners in general trying to get involved in inspiring and maybe in propelling oppositional forces to take to the streets, it is, to my mind, counterproductive, and in most cases, it will not work.
Thank you, Professor, very much. Operator, if you have a question, if you want to, we're ready to take them. Thank you.
Your first question is from the line of Dorothy Schoengood.
Yes, I would like to ask you, if Egypt does become a democracy, do you feel that it will spread to other Arab countries in the Middle East, and how will that affect Israel?
Okay, can I answer this now, or you want
yes,
me to collect
please.
A couple of questions?
No, I think we should answer them as they come up, Professor, if that's okay with you.
So you want me to answer?
Yes, please.
Yeah, okay. So I would say that the way that I read the impact of the events in Tunisia and in Egypt is metaphorically, I would say this is a regional earthquake. You have the focal point where all this erupted, let's say, Tunisia first, and then much more massive erupting in Egypt. And then you will have impact on other centers, but not necessarily on the very same scale. That means that we already have seen impacts of the events in Egypt, in Jordan, in Yemen, in Morocco, and within the Palestinian society. One symbolic expression of this is that if you listen to the Arabic slogans that been raised, that were raised in Cairo, you can hear them now coming out from protesters in Algeria and in Yemen, and they are the same. They are asking downfall the regime. They are not saying downfall Hosni Mubarak because it is gone. So the slogan is downfall with the regime, and this can be replicated by others, of course. Now, my point here is that even if we see more of demonstrations and maybe even more forceful demonstrations in other Arab states, this should not be seen as necessarily leading to the same result. That means that it will not end up all the time with the resignation of the president or a king, but the more interesting here, I think, is that all over the Middle East, you have today this, I would say, atmosphere that we live in, like an era that you have not only the stick of the regime, the security forces, that we live in an era that there are more tools to be used by the civil population against authoritarian regimes. And then, and of course, it creates a lot of upheavals and a lot of even instability in some in several centers of the Middle East.
Thank you.
Our next question is from the line of Alexander Gorin.
Yes, good morning. What effect, if any, do you think what is happening in Egypt and in other Middle Eastern states can have on the imminent West Bank elections?
Again, it's a very, I think, crucial and important question. What is similar is that in the West Bank, especially in the West Bank, among the civil population, the PA, the Palestinian Authority, and especially the leadership of Mr. Abu Mazen, is not getting that much of popularity and support. Of course, we are all aware that there is a continuous friction and struggle between the two major opponents, in one hand Fatah and the PLO, and on the other side you have Hamas. And Hamas actually looking into the situation or the uprising in Egypt as a huge, I would say, a huge support for their claim, and they already started the Egyptian army and the Egyptian public opinion in general to open the Rafah crossing. And in the other side, within the PLO, especially in the West Bank, the leadership fully understand that they have no other choice but to go very soon into national elections for the parliament. Now, this is an issue that is has been controversial for at least since Hamas won election back in January 2006. So this is very sensitive, and we believe that during the coming the next summer we will have elections into the Palestinian parliament. The parties already started working within the public opinion, preparing for this election campaign. It will, of course, have implications for Israel, and of course, I mean, first and foremost, for any prospect of renewal of the political negotiation or talks between the two parties. And as we know, this has been stopped about a year ago. So at the moment, immediate impact I do not see, but in the coming months, if we go to elections, we can see the impact of the events in Egypt on the West Bank.
Thank you.
Your next question is from the line of Murray Fromson from Los Angeles. Marie, your line is open. Your next question is from the line of William Merovitz from Chicago.
Thank you very much. A couple weeks ago, Tom Friedman wrote a very interesting column about the timeliness of getting a peace deal done between the Israel and the Palestinians, and the fact that Israel will never have more leverage than they have right now. And in view of what's going on in Egypt and throughout the Middle East, his view was, it's a view that I share, that nothing could be more important right now than getting that peace deal done and moving it forward with the help, active help of the United States. How do you feel about that, and how do you think the Israeli street feels about that?
Of course, Tom Friedman's piece was published before this regional earthquake in Tunisia and in Egypt, and to my mind, as I already said, it will have impacts on the potential peace talk between Israel and the Palestinians. What I think is that we are now in a stage that, in one hand, about 50 or maybe 60% of the Israeli public opinion will support renewal of the negotiations and talks between Israel and the Palestinians. But my reading of the situation is that we are not even close to opening such talks. It's not about my personal like or dislike. It's more about the reading of the reading of the situation. The two parties, I would say, are too weak to be politically, domestically, internally, too weak to be wise and to get back to the negotiation table. In addition to this, as I read it, the current American administration has been over-occupied now with reading this shaky and new map in the Middle East, which could affect dramatically the United States Middle East policy, and not only relationships with Egypt or Tunisia or the Palestinians. We are now in a very fluid situation, and in this situation, I think that especially the current government in Jerusalem would not rush into talks with the Palestinians. In general, I think that all eyes will be focusing now on the political upheavals in the Middle East. It's not a good news to what in general we call the peace camp here in Israel or in other side or in the United States, but priority now is to understand the situation that we are going through all over the Middle East, and then to see major questions, who are the parties, the leadership, what at stake when we think about the coming Egyptian government, or if something happened in Jordan, what then? And of course, this is directly relevant to the political situation in the Palestinian polity and street.
If I could just follow up with that question. When you say that the two leaders are too weak, and I assume you're talking about the Palestinian leaders when you say they're too weak, am I correct? You're talking about the Palestinian leaders?
No. I meant the two parties, the Israeli and the Palestinians. Weak politically, I said, means that, yes, of course, you have a very stable I would say that the that if we take the Netanyahu's government, in one end we can say this is a very stable government, a broad coalition with difficulties, but I would say I would put a lot of attention on the fragile situation within this coalition. Foreign Minister Viktor Lieberman could withdraw from the government anytime he wants, and he plays with this stick recently. And I would say that if Netanyahu would try to get involved in serious negotiation with the Palestinians, with the support of the Americans, I would not exclude the possibility that Netanyahu will find himself in a very problematic political situation in the Knesset and in his own government.
But under that circumstance, couldn't he just make a deal with Tzipi Livnik and Kadima if Lieberman and the Shas and the far-right wingers were out of the government and form a coalition government that could proceed with the peace process?
I don't think so. I think that there are huge differences about what we call in general the peace process between Kadima party and the Likud. They already discussed this possibility a couple of times during the last year, and all time they ended up with that this is a no way or no go for each of them from his own reading of the political situation. I would say that unfortunately, I do not see the Israeli and the Palestinian getting even close to the negotiation table in the near future.
Thank you. It is unfortunate.
It is, indeed.
Your next question is from the line of Howard Sun from San Francisco.
Yes, my question is how you see, Professor Maital, how you see the these developments relative to the Arab minority in Israel and how it might respond to these democratizing trends relative to its own position in Israeli society?
This is an excellent question, and excuse me. In general, the Arab citizens in Israel celebrated the uprising in Tunisia and especially in Egypt. Mubarak was not popular among the more national wing within the Arab citizens within Israel, and in not few cases they demonstrated against Egypt's policy, mainly during Kast-led operation in Gaza. So when the news came with the uprising in Egypt and the downfall of Mubarak, there was a sort of a festive atmosphere within the Arab citizens in Israel. So this is the first point. The second point is about is something very interesting about the power of the people, and this is and this has to do with the point that I already mentioned a couple of minutes ago about this new mood in the Middle East. And the power of the people is the cry, and they believe that as a minority within Israel who has struggled for many years to improve their economic situation, improve the infrastructure in Arab villages and cities, that this new wave of people power is playing a role model, and that they can take some lessons from this and civilianly fighting into improving their domestic internal condition in Israel.
Your next question is from the line of AABGU, Greater New York Region.
Yes, you had mentioned the Gaza Strip, and I'm to follow up on that. I'm intrigued by the situation in the Sinai, and also in the Suez Canal with two Iranian warships attempting to come through and around to the Mediterranean. In the Sinai, of course, there was the demolition of the natural gas pipeline, which I take it is continuing to have a major impact on the Israeli economy, a major negative impact. And obviously the Gaza Strip abutted largely by the Sinai. What will happen there?
Well, for not few years, as we all are aware of, the Sinai territory has been like a territory that only in small parts been under a strict control of the Egyptian forces. I don't know if we all aware of the military annex of the peace treaty between Israel and Egypt, but according to this peace treaty, the numbers of soldiers and their weapons in Sinai is extremely limited from obvious reasons. No one had expected in 1979 and 1978 that we will face one day a problem of refugees coming through Sinai in tens of thousands or smuggling arms and all these difficulties that we all aware of. Back then, the situation was that we should prevent anything close to the 1973 Yom Kippur War. Now, about 30 years later on, means today, the situation is not only have changed dramatically, but pose a lot of challenges to the two parties. Now, even today, during this transitional phase in Egypt, the responsibility for security in both Sinai and the Suez Canal is in the hand of the Egyptian Supreme Commander of the Army. And from the Israeli perspective, this is the best addressee they could have imagined, especially nowadays in Egypt. So the very beginning of the uprising, the Egyptian army asked Israel's permission to send more troops, about 800 soldiers and officers, into Sinai just to reinforce forces to prevent anyone taking advantage of the uprising in Egypt. Now, as you rightly mentioned, they failed to safeguard this gas station in North Sinai, and we already heard about these two ships that I guess continue to making their way through the Suez Canal to Syria from Iran. Now, this is very delicate and very problematic situation. I mean, crossing of Iranian navy or military ships through the Suez Canal. But here we should take into account that they are not the only military ships that crossing this international waterway, the Suez Canal, and this is including, of course, Israeli Navy that using this canal. So in the legal level, Israel facing here a huge challenge to try to convince the Egyptians that Americans and Israeli Navy could use the Suez Canal, but Iranians should be prevented from this. It poses a huge legal question to the Egyptian. Here, we can see an example for the close cooperation that Israel had with the Mubarak's regime at the time. This could not happen under Mubarak. He perfectly understood the legal situation, but Mubarak's government have been in a huge conflict with the Iranians for decades, actually from the beginning of the Islamic Revolution by Ayatollah Khomeini. I believe that the Iranians decided actually to make their point by testing and sending these two ships through the Suez Canal and to try to maybe embarrass the new Egyptian Supreme Army commanders. But I don't have any other information about this out of my reading of the situation.
Thank you.
Thank you, Professor, very much. Believe it or not, we've actually run out of time for the phone conference, and thank you for your very, very insightful analysis and insights, and hopefully we will be able to do this again in the future, and, you know, yeah, just wonderful having the ability to have an exceptional scholar like yourself available to all of us. We feel very, very fortunate, and I know the students at the university are very fortunate to have you.
Thank you so much. It was my pleasure, and I wish all of us good night and shalom.
Thank you very much, Professor, and thank you, everybody, for being on the phone call, and thank you for sharing the vision of Ben-Gurion to make Ben-Gurion University a world-class institution that it is in education and research in the Negev. As far as future events, Ben-Gurion has a website, www.aabgu.org, and has very interesting material on the website. So thank you all, and everybody have a very good day. Thank you, Professor, again.
Okay, bye. Good night, bye-bye.
Good night, bye-bye.
Good night.
Good night, everybody. Goodbye, everybody.
This concludes today's conference call. You may now disconnect.